This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
These two approaches, the techno-Anthropocene and the lean-green Anthropocene, are fundamentally opposed. They're mutually exclusive, and it's kind of, okay, which route are we going to take?
There's a scientific debate afoot in geological and environmental circles about what to call the current time period. According to the International Union of Geological Sciences, we're living in the Holocene epoch. But many believe that the term Anthropocene would better reflect the impact that humankind has had and is continuing to have on the planet. This week on Sea Change Radio, we discuss the Anthropocene with Richard Heinberg of the Post Carbon Institute. We look at why the terminology debate is more than just semantics, and examine a division among environmentalists between what Heinberg has dubbed the techno-Anthropocene proponents and the lean green movement. I'm joined now again by Richard Heinberg. He's a senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute. Richard, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Good to be with you again, Alex.
So you have a new piece coming online at Earth Island Journal on their website about the Anthropocene. I thought it was very interesting. Why don't you first take a step back and tell us what the Anthropocene is? What does this term mean?
Well, it's a term that was proposed back in the 1980s by an ecologist named Gene Stermer. And it's been widely popularized by a Nobel Prize winning atmospheric chemist named Paul Crutzen. And the idea is that, we name geological eras and epochs. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that geologists, if we have geologists around, 10,000 or 100,000 or a million years from now, they will be able to see in the rocks when the industrial revolution happened, because of evidence like climate change, because of the dispersal of all kinds of minerals that we've been mining and making into products and that have been going up into the atmosphere and into the water and so on, because of species extinctions, because of the acidification of the Earth's oceans. All of these things, the evidence of them will be visible to geologists. So in effect, we're creating a new geological epoch. So shouldn't we call it something different? And so the Anthropocene is, anthro is a Greek for human, and scene, C-E-N-E, is a suffix also from Greek meaning new, which is common to all the recent geological epochs like the Holocene, part of the Cenozoic era. So this is gaining some serious respect among geologists. There was the Geological Society of London in 2008. There was a proposal presented to the Stratigraphy Commission to make the Anthropocene a formal unit of geological epoch divisions, and since then it's been in study groups, and it's just a matter of time, I think, before it's formally adopted as the name for our particular little slice of time in Earth's multi-billion-year history.
let's put this in perspective. The Cenozoic era, which you just mentioned, began around 65 million years ago until, I believe, around 11 million years ago. And then you get the Pleistocene era until around 10,000 years ago when the Holocene came in. But so we're talking man's footprint on this planet has maybe been comparable to these multi-million year epochs. Is that what people are postulating?
That's exactly right. They're saying that the influence of human beings is as great as whatever it was that caused the dinosaur extinction 65 million years ago, whether it was a comet most of these major geological divisions mm-hmm. have correlated with significant climate change. So the fact that we're causing climate change today as a result of greenhouse gas emissions is, in effect, you know, by itself, that is forcing a change in the geological condition.
And when you were researching this piece, Richard, did you find any scientists who are trying to put this last century of massive fossil fuel burning into perspective when you compare it to some of the other landmarks, I guess you would say, or thresholds in this 10,000-year Anthropocene, such as the Industrial Revolution or the Age of Exploration, going through mass natural resources like the deforestation of England and coal burning in the 19th century. How does this last century stack up?
Among the proponents of the Anthropocene idea, there are early Anthropocene advocates, and they say that we should start counting basically at the beginning of agriculture or maybe even before then, because people have been altering environments significantly for a very long time. Even when we were hunters and gatherers, we were using fire to alter landscapes in a very substantial way. I mean, you look at continents like North America and Australia, and the evidence is just overwhelming that, you know, these continents were, you know, profoundly changed as a result of human presence. Also, early human hunters hunted a lot of big game animals to extinction, to the point where, you know, if you want to try to determine the exact time when humans arrived on a Pacific island or in North America or South America or Australia, a big sign is when all of these large land birds and mammals started to go extinct. You can trace human arrival almost exactly to that same point in time. So there's also a good argument for dating the beginning of the Anthropocene just to the start of when we began using fossil fuels, the start of the Industrial Revolution, coal, oil, and natural gas. You know, you can argue either way, and it's really just a matter of emphasis. But, you know, for geologists, 10,000 years one way or another is not that big a deal anyway. We're used to dealing in millions and billions mm-hmm. of years.
What does this labeling mean for the scientific community as a whole? This is still just a subset of the Holocene era, correct?
In a sense, the Holocene would be renamed as a result of this, or at least, as you say, a large subset of the Holocene. In other words, we're not talking about the Anthropocene as a subset of the Holocene. We really are talking about a new epoch altogether. And, you know, for one species, for us human beings to cause this big a deal in Earth's history, that's really saying something.
Well, the one thing that gives me hope is that when you look at the Anthropocene, it could look rather bleak, but then you also have to take into account that humans, besides being the most devastating species for Earth, are also in the unique position of being the brightest and the most empathetic and caring for other species. Is there a chance that we could look another 10,000 years down the road and look in the geological record and perhaps see a demarcation point in the Anthropocene where man kind of got its act together and the waters began to recede and the and some endangered species began to flourish again.
There are actually two competing, very different visions of how that, you know, better Anthropocene might emerge. You know, it's clear, you know, if we just keep doing what we're doing now, the result is going to be pretty bleak. You know, the oceans will basically be populated by jellyfish, and the land surface will be mostly a few generalist species like rats and cockroaches. but there are two, as I say, two competing groups of theorists who say the Anthropocene doesn't have to be so bad. One of those groups says basically, we broke it, so it's ours, and basically we should take over Earth's ecosystems completely and re-engineer them more successfully. Who's saying this? Well, there's a British writer named Mark Lynas, who wrote a book called The God Species, Stuart Brand, who started the, what was the famous magazine back in the 1970s?
The Whole Earth.
Catalog.
He's,
right.
He's been on the show on Sea Change Radio. He was a merry prankster and one of the original hippies, but a very interesting and controversial character, mostly for his pro-nuclear stance.
Right.
And pro-GMO as well.
Right. And Michael Schellenberger and Ted Nordhaus of the Breakthrough Institute. And they basically all are saying, look, you know, we're just getting started. Wilderness is basically gone. The Earth is now in our hands, and we just have to get better as geoengineers.
And I know that the Breakthrough Institute, one of their real issues that I think causes a lot of rancor within the environmental movement is that they believe that the need by the first world to try to cut back on fossil fuel consumption is unrealistic, because that's what the developing world wants, and who are we to try to cut back on consumption? Basically, we're on this path and we have to just find solutions. We can't find ways to cut back on our fossil fuel usage. We just have to make it cleaner.
Right.
So, sorry to interrupt. Go on.
The other group is what in the article I call the lean green Anthropocene advocates. And these are folks who are saying, well, we've got to cut back. There's basically no choice for any number of reasons. Limits to fossil fuels, limits to other energy sources, and also limits to minerals and metals in the Earth's crust, the fragility of ecosystems, and our inability to competently engineer ecosystems without just damaging them. These people say, look, there are ways of reducing human impact, and we'd be stupid not to use them. And this type of thinking really started back in the 1970s. I cite two Australian ecologists, David Holmgren and Bill Mollison, who came up with a program they called permaculture, which Mollison describes as a philosophy of working with rather than against nature, of protracted and thoughtful observation rather than thoughtless labor, of looking at plants and animals and all their functions rather than treating any area as a single product system. So they're basically talking about how we can fit in with nature better and yet still have our basic needs met. There are folks who are working on making more sustainable organic food production, like Wes Jackson of the Land Institute, who's spent four decades breeding perennial grain crops because he thinks that our current annual grain crops are responsible for most of the, you know, 25 billion tons a year of soil erosion that goes on. Community resilience efforts, the population, the organizations working to reduce or limit human population so that we don't have, you know, increasing demand on all these resources as a result of that. working to localize food systems, capture carbon in the soil and replant forests, recycling, reusing, making more durable goods, rethinking economics so that we have more human satisfaction without the need for endless growth. All of this is what you could call the lean green approach to the Anthropocene. And these two approaches, the techno-Anthropocene that people like Stuart Brand and Ted Nordhaus and all of those folks are advocating, and the lean green Anthropocene are fundamentally opposed. They're mutually exclusive, and it's kind of, okay, which route are we going to take?
You say it's yes, and then it's no. You say you'll stay, and then you go. You're undecided now. So what are you gonna do? First you say you do, and then you don't. And then you say you will, and then you won't. You're undecided now. So what are you gonna do? Now you wanna play, and then it's no. And when you say you'll stay, that's when you go. You're undecided now. So what are you gonna do? I've been sitting on a fence, and it doesn't make much sense, 'cause you keep me in suspense, and you know...
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Richard Heinberg. He's a senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute. So we're talking about the two green movements, the lean green movement and the techno-Anthropocene movement, all within this context of the Anthropocene and this piece that you penned for Earth Island Institute. So you say that these two movements are mutually exclusive, but let's pick that apart if we can, because
sure.
These groups are not fundamentally opposed in that they're both quote-unquote green. They have the same goal in mind in general. Is that a fair enough postulation?
Yeah, well, a lot of the techno-Anthropocene folks regard themselves as or are generally regarded as environmentalists.
Right. And the reason I've had them on, and Stuart Brand and members of the Breakthrough Institute like Alex Trembath and Jesse Jenkins, is that I think what they have to say is important. They're not just putting their head in the sand. If these groups are moving in the same direction, couldn't there be some middle ground where we do find these solutions that work for both organizations? Obviously, that silver bullet has not been found. They're promoting nuclear energy as a great fix over at the Breakthrough Institute. But obviously, the lean green perspective is quite different. So they're going to differ on issues such as nuclear energy and GMOs feeding the world. But there must be some common ground, don't you think, Richard?
There probably is common ground in some details. I mean, I think probably, just about everyone we're talking about would welcome, say, something like a carbon tax. But it's where you look at the general trajectory of their arguments that the big division appears. Generally, the techno-Anthropocene folks assume that it is possible and desirable to keep the current growth trajectory of industrial civilization intact, but we should do it with greener means, if you will. In other words, we should find a way to do that that doesn't imperil future generations and hopefully leaves some other species intact. The lean green folks say, well, it's neither possible nor desirable to continue with our current industrial growth trajectory, that in fact, over the long run, planet Earth is only going to be able to sustain a smaller human population than we currently have at lower rates of consumption. So we should take that into account and aim in that direction rather than deluding ourselves that somehow we can continue to increase our consumption of resources on what is, after all, a finite planet. So these are two very different outlooks on the future, on what's possible and also what's desirable.
So basically, the lean green approach is their Achilles heel is human nature, that we're counting on habits to change in 7 billion people on the planet, while the techno Anthropocene, their Achilles heel is this silver bullet, which right now the only silver bullet they can find is nuclear energy that could deliver the kind of the scale that is required immediately to try to cut back on it. I think both goals are unrealistic right now, but one is shooting maybe too high, trying to shift mindsets of so many people. And by the same token, the techno-Anthropocene followers are setting their goal a little too low in that, like, we just want to get rid of coal. And because that's basically their argument. When Fukushima happened, they were like, you know, what's going to replace nuclear energy if it goes away in Japan? Coal. And that has been the case.
Right. Yeah, it's a tough one. And the reason energy is so important to the techno-Anthropocene folks' argument is that basically all of our solutions to human problems right now depend upon more energy. You know, as the weather gets stranger and places like California and Arizona dry up, where do we get more fresh water? Well, we could desalinate ocean water, but that would require more energy. You know, as farmland gets polluted, as is happening in China right now, 20% of their farmland is too polluted to grow crops now. Okay, what do we do? Well, we can grow food in hydroponic greenhouses. We don't need soil. Oh, except that requires a lot of energy for building those greenhouses and operating them. As we deplete minerals and metals, the whole list from antimony to zinc, we're mining and refining lower and lower grade ores all the time. And the only way that works is with more energy. So
similar to fracking and our oil production in places like Saudi Arabia, where more and more water has to be injected into these large wells.
Right, right. So the point is, if we can't find that magic bullet energy source that's capable of growing our total societal energy supply significantly and soon, then the whole idea of, you know, basically taking charge of nature and re-engineering it according to our vision just kind of falls apart. It just doesn't work. So where are we? You know, if the techno-Anthropocene message falls short because we just won't have enough energy, and if the lean greens message doesn't appeal to its audience enough to make much of a difference, could we be facing a kind of ecological slapdown? And I think most of the serious environmental scientists that I talk to on a regular basis have pretty much resigned themselves that's where we're headed.
It's not easy being green, having to spend each day in the color of the leaves, when it could be nicer being red, yellow or gold, or something much more colorful like that. It's not easy being green. You seem to blend in with so many ordinary everyday things. People tend to pass you by because you're not standing out like sparkles in the water, stars in the sky. But green's the color of spring. Oh, yeah.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Richard Heinberg. He's a senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute. I think one of the things that doesn't connect within the lean green movement is that a lot of the solutions would come from urbanization and economies of scale in a more concentrated place. But the message is usually more pastoral, like composting in your backyard and living closer to nature and being more of a community. But when you consider that places that are less concentrated in population, the energy and the water and the services are a lot more straining to the quote-unquote grid, if you will. It's not a scalable solution for everybody to move to Vermont and do their own composting, obviously. So that's where I think some of the messaging gets lost. Is that fair to say?
Well, yeah, it's, you know, it's a conundrum because on one hand, everything you just said is true. And a lot of the best green thinking is happening in urban areas and the best recycling programs and all of that. And it's also true that the mega cities that we've created over the past century of, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 million people all living in one conurbation, these things are inherently unsustainable. And as energy becomes more scarce and expensive, you know, we're going to have to live closer to the land in a lot of different ways. Now, whether that means, you know, folks in suburbs growing more food in their backyards and keeping chickens, or whether it means people moving to where they can be more self-sufficient, you know, I think we'll see both of these trends.
So let me quote from your article, Richard, and we can tie this back into the Anthropocene discussion. So you say, gradually more and more people will conclude, again, as a result of hard experience, that nature isn't here just for us. Whether this realization emerges from extreme weather, plagues, or resource scarcity, it will lead an ever-expanding share of the populace grudgingly to pay more attention to forces beyond human control. So what lessons can humans take from this? We're a species who likes to control. How will we behave when we're faced with this reality?
Well, you know, people have lived through boom times and not so boom times throughout history. Even in pre-agricultural times, when the first people arrived on a new continent and found, you know, lots of large prey animals, that was, you know, here, what an ecological opportunity, and human population would increase and spread and so on. Those were boom times, just like, you know, when we discovered oil in the 1860s. And ever since then, we've been on an incredible, unprecedented boom. On the other hand, when people get slapped down from time to time as a result of ecological limits, they learn how to live within limits. You know, we talk about the Native Americans and the Aboriginal Australians as kind of intuitive ecologists because they had these traditions and rituals that limited population growth and consumption. Well, it wasn't that they were some kind of, you know, genetically different people from the rest of us who are, you know, driving our cars and so on. It's because they learned from hard experience that if they over-harvested resources, they paid for it in the end. I think we're going to be learning the same lesson as the Anthropocene proceeds. Maybe the deepest insight of the Anthropocene will be a very simple one, that we live in a world of millions of interdependent species that we've co-evolved with. And this web of life is something that we break at our peril. The Earth's story is fascinating. It's rich in detail. We play a big part in it. But in the final analysis, it's not just all about us.
Well, it's a fascinating piece, and it's not published yet, but we will, when it does come out, we will post it on our Facebook page and our Twitter feed, which is at Sea Change Radio. Senior Fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute, Richard Heinberg. Richard, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Hugh Masekela, the Ames Brothers, and Van Morrison. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidioedu.org. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com.
That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.